Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And you're welcome back. And I want to go to Paul Graham. Good afternoon, Paul.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Paul, you have an extraordinary life story with an extraordinary twist at the end.
Yes, indeed.
Just explain to people, you were born in the Bethany home.
That's correct. I was born in Bethany Roofgar in 1939. My real mother came from Castle Derg, and in those days, she was a strong Church of Ireland. You didn't have babies unless you were married, and the church would send them down to the south, and they went to Bethany Home, and they had to be there 2 months before the birth, and then they had to stay 4 months after the birth to pay back the money that they would have spent on having the birth or something. So they had to work there for 4 months after they had the birth, and they signed a bit of paper saying they had no interest in the child.
Mm-hmm. So your mother, this is something you discovered way down the line, but from childhood, did you know from very early on that you were born in Bethany and that you were adopted?
No, it was very, very strange. I had a terrible childhood and I ran away from home when I was about 14, I think. I was adopted a couple of times, but the last people that adopted me came from Belfast.
When you say you were adopted a couple of times, Paul, how did that happen?
Yeah, well, I only found this out last year because of the information. We've been working maybe 18 years. It's 20 years this month since I first started to look for my mother. Mm-hmm. And I had I think it's called PACT, an organisation in Dublin called PACT. I had the Salvation Army in Australia contact them, and they got the records and said, in fact, my name was not Paul at all, it was Maurice.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, your mother was born in the north of Ireland, and if you come over to Dublin and meet our people, we'll explain it to you. So I flew from Australia with my wife to Dublin, and they went to this organization, and they said, yes, your mother was called Mary, and here's their... She was one of seven sisters, and there's still one sister living, and she lives in Castle Derg, and she'd love to meet with you. If you'd like to go to the phone there, you can ring her up because she's your aunt. And she was the most beautiful person, called Aunt Muriel, and she gave me the first photograph I ever had of my mother. And I would have been maybe some 89, so maybe about 60 years of age before I got a photograph of my mother.
Wow. And so take us right back, though, Paul, to your very early childhood. So what you discovered about that childhood. So you said you were adopted more than once.
Yes, because records show that. So I was born in 1939, but I wasn't actually adopted the last time till 1944. So I often wonder what was in between those years. I only found out the other day, actually, that what happened was Bethany Homes would... a horrible word, but the farm would farm out babies. So we were farmed out to a family in Wicklow. This lady had five children of her own,
mm-hmm.
and she had 15 babies from Bethany Home. All babies. So she had 20 babies. And she was, it wasn't anything to do that she was a caring person. It was the fact that she could get 15 shillings per week from the government for looking after the babies.
So she was looking after 15 babies at the same time?
15 babies at the same time from Bethany Homes.
Wow.
And the church arranged all that, and she got 15 shillings a week for each child. So it was a money thing. And then you were sent back to Bethany. Then I was adopted by, or sent to somebody in Finglas. I never met their I don't know their name, but the records we've been getting in the last 6 months, I suppose, this information's coming around, that I was sent to somebody in Finglas, and then they didn't like me or whatever it was, and I was sent back to Bethany.
Yeah. And then you did end up with a family full-time then?
Then I ended up with a family. They came down from Belfast, very wealthy Belfast family. And I suppose, I remember when I was maybe seven, I was sent from Belfast down to Dublin to be a boarder at Wesley College, and I was only 7 years of age. And then I caught chicken pox, I think. I can remember that, and coming back up the north again. And the people who adopted me were very, very wealthy. I mean, I remember watching Mickey Mouse movies on her own projector and all these things. This is like 1940-odd. But it ended up my stepmother became an alcoholic, and she was just terrible. I mean, we got beat and everything else, and I was told my real mother was just a prostitute. She was no good, and you're no good. And
so it wasn't a happy childhood.
It was terrible, absolutely terrible. The beatings and the, you know, I just wasn't, nobody ever told me they loved me until I married. And I left home, I forged the signature on the papers to get me into the Royal Marine. The only thing you could join those days at 14 was the Royal Marine Band, as a band boy. And I signed the papers and I left Belfast on the Haitian boat. I went over to England to become a band boy at the age of 14. At 14 and a half, the Royal Marine Band said, Paul, you haven't got a musical note in your body. You could never play anything. And I said, well, I've got no family. He said, don't worry, we look after our own. We're going to transfer you to the Royal Navy. And they transferred me to the Royal Navy. And I remember when I was maybe 16, coming home and leave. Everybody else had leave. And I came home, and the house where I lived, there was nobody there. My stepmother was in a mental hospital. My stepfather was in a TB hospital. And I had no home. And you can imagine a 16-year-old with all my kit bag and my hammock. And I had to find somewhere to live, and I went to the Seaman's Mission. And that's where I spent my leave, and it was terrible. I had no one in the world at all to say hello or love me or anything, and I was 16 years of age.
And tell me, how did you end up going to Australia then?
Well, when I spent about 17 years in the Royal Navy, I loved it because that was my family. The time I came out, I had a son, two sons, I think at that time. And I went to live in Belfast with my wife was a pen pal. I was in Malaya fighting when I was maybe 18. And someone, I can never remember to this day who it was, where I found her address. It may have been in a cigarette packet, because she worked in cigarettes, packing cigarettes, and the girls would put their name and address in for us to write to them. And she was 16, and I started to write to her from Malaya. And I didn't meet her till 18 months later. And when I went to Belfast to meet her, I asked her to marry me, and she said, no, you come back when you're sober. And we were married a year later. She was 19, I was 20, 21. We've been married 60 years next week.
Oh, congratulations. She said, come back when you're sober. Did you have issues with alcohol at that stage? Or?
Oh, I was terrible. Not as bad. I mean, in the Navy, everybody drank. So it wasn't a big problem. But when I came into Civvy Street, I never drank like normal people. I drank to get away to fantasy world, and it became a huge problem. And probably the reason I went to Australia was, you know, the grass was greener the other side. It was £10. We arrived in Australia with $100 in our pocket and three kids. And she was married to an alcoholic, and I was drinking maybe a bottle of gin a day or something. It was terrible. I was hospitalized a lot of times. And then I was in the hospital, and a man came to see me from Derry. And we used to call him Derry Bill. Derry Bill had nothing. He lived in a little one-bedroom place in Sydney. His wife had died. And he spent his life going round the hospices, holding the hands of the dying and going to the alcoholic hospitals. And he just said to me, Paul, you know, he said, you're a decent man. You can get better. And I actually believed him. And that was the biggest thing ever happened in my life. It took me quite a while to come to terms with the booze, and then I had to face up to reality, which was my childhood, the things that happened to me. Without going into naming, I was raped when I was 9. I was raped when I was 11, and all this had to be sorted out in my brain, and I did it all through this bloke. God bless him. He'd take me every night to Alcoholics Anonymous and just said, just sit there and listen. And gradually I got better, and it changed my whole life round. I forgive everybody, and I realized that let it be. Then when I find my mother, I I suppose every man wants to find his mum, and a girl wants to find her dad.
How did that start? Like you said, not until 1986 did you start looking for your mother.
That's when I started, and it would have been maybe 10 years. I can't remember. I've got dementia. I can't remember the time date. Anyway, I went to Castle Derg, met her sister, and she gave me a photograph of my mum. Mm-hmm. So only last year, and then all the family went to Castle Derg and met my aunt. She was a wonderful woman. She died. She was 90-odd, I think. Lived in a little farm up in the mountains there. And but she didn't tell me everything. You know, it was just still taboo. You know, she was a strong Presbyterian or whatever she wore, Church of Ireland. And I just didn't talk about it. And I went there wanting to know more, but she wouldn't tell me. So last year, my daughter-in-law was doing this. She does this genealogy thing. And I was always, my kids went to kindergarten and they do a family tree, and my side was always empty. And that really hurt me, you know?
Yeah.
Because I belonged somewhere. Anyway, she found my mother's death certificate. And she died in London, I don't know, many years ago, I can't remember. And it was signed by her son. This was only last year. And on the death certificate, it had his address. So I wrote him a nice letter and enclosed a photograph of my mother and said, I believe this is your mother and my mother. If you don't want to respond to this letter, I fully understand. Just throw it away. However, if you do, you know, it would make me happy. His wife rang me maybe 3 days, 4 days later, crying, and said, my husband is your brother.
Wow.
And I couldn't believe it. It was just, they accepted me so well.
But it must have been But Paul, I mean, what an extraordinary thing to learn. This is just last year.
Yeah.
And what age are you last year?
Just last year. I was 79. He is 76, I think. He's 3 years younger than me. And they were, my son went to London last year and met them. And she had all the family there, my nephews and nieces, their grandchildren, and they all said, this is your family. They sent me a photograph of everybody and said, this is all yours. And I FaceTime Rodney every Sunday night from Australia. He doesn't talk much. Some days he knows who I am. Some days he doesn't.
Because
that's fine.
He has health issues himself now.
He's got bad dementia. I have dementia, but it's a funny type of dementia. It's only when I get tired or when I get emotionally disturbed. I love the article. I loved listening to the person you were talking about beforehand, because my wife has the same issues with me.
Mm-hmm.
I when I first got diagnosed, I'd go to a coffee shop, I'd start crying, thinking she wasn't going to come back for me. And the coffee shop man would say, don't worry, Paul, she's going to come back. And now he knows me, and I don't have an issue anymore. Mm-hmm. But at first, it was very, very hard. Anyway, so the people who raped me the headmaster of a very private school in Belfast.
Oh.
And I remember as if it was yesterday, going to the doctor and getting examined, and yes, 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 they reported to the police. Nothing was done. The guy was just sent to another school. And then the second time, I was raped by a man who went on to become the master, the grandmaster.
Okay, I'm just going to stop you there, Paul.
Yes,
I want to bring you up to where you were talking about your brother, Rodney.
Yes.
Did he know that you existed? Had he ever known that there was another brother?
Did not have a clue.
Wow.
They did not know. And it's just the way it was. And the beautiful thing was, his wife said to me, your mother, Paul, was the best mother-in-law I could ever wish for. And I'd been brought up hating my mother because she was a prostitute. And she wasn't.
And what was he able to tell you about your mother, Paul?
Eh?
What was he able to tell you about your mother then?
She just said, look, we didn't know you had your mother. She was in the Women's Royal Air Force in Northern Ireland. And he came over from the RAF in England during the war. And they had a dance and they both met. And they got married, went back to live in London. He became a professor of economics at Oxford University or something. A very brainy man. And they had a lovely life. And she said, look, your mother was the best mother-in-law you could ever wish for. In fact, I had an email from one of her sons yesterday, who, funny enough, is called Paul as well. And he said to me, I just wanted to let you know before I see you that my granny was the best granny you could wish for. She was a beautiful woman. And, you know, it made me feel so peaceful that somebody finally was saying that somebody loved me, my mother. You know what I mean?
And that she was a lovely person.
That she wasn't a prostitute. And I could fully understand at last. You know, people want to know why I love Danny Boy. If you really listen to the words of that, that's exactly how I felt, that I could finally come to terms, walk on your grave, and forgive. That is just, it might not mean much to people, but meant so much to me. And all I'm saying is, I am a citizen of nowhere, because the British government said I was born before 1948, therefore I'm only a British subject, not a British citizen, despite the fact I spent 17 years in their services. The Irish government are saying you're not an Irish citizen because there's no such person as Paul Graham. You have to prove that Paul Graham is Maurice. And I said, I have an Irish birth certificate. There it is. I sent you all the information to the Bethany Homes. They said, oh, no, you've got to get a lawyer and actually prove to us. So I went to the embassy in Canberra. I've written to the Taoiseach. I've written to the minister. They're all just saying, well, you have to, it's a legal thing. We're not going to make you. Now, I said, mate, I was born in Ireland. I feel Irish. I have in my arm an Irish harp, which I got engraved on there when I was probably 17, fighting in the jungle. All I'm asking for, why is the Catholic things, babies' homes, were all the Catholic Church admitted it, there was redress. They will not give redress to the Protestant babies' homes. In this day and age, why would we separate whatever religion you were? We're all Irish.
And do you have, Paul, do you have records from the Bethany home to show that
yes.
you were born there?
Yes, I have everything. I have letters that... Now, the Church of Ireland is denying the fact that they ran Bethany home. Probably legally, maybe they didn't. They had a trusteeship. But I have letters from the Archbishop of Dublin in the 1940s showing names of people who had donated money to Bethany homes. And in this letter, particular letter, he's advising Bethany, saying that so-and-so left £1,000 in his will. Don't spend the £1,000. Put £500 off the mortgage, and I want you to invest the other £500 in bonds. And the church is advising them what to do. And, you know, I only find out by I met a fellow survivor in Belfast yesterday, Jim Fenning. Mm-hmm. And he was telling me he went down to the Church of Ireland in Belfast and said, look, you did all this. And they said, oh, no, we didn't. And he showed them the letters from the Archbishop. I mean, I wrote to the Archbishop of Ireland, and he wrote me back a legal letter. If I can get you counselling in Australia, would you accept it? And I thought, how dare you? And I wrote back to him and said, you call yourself a Christian, you have no compassion, you have no love, you're living behind the law, and you're sending me lawyers' letters. So then I wrote to the Archbishop of Canterbury, and I got a lovely letter back saying, look, I understand exactly what is wrong. He says, I will confer with the Archbishop of Ireland on your behalf. And then, you know, I'm a good letter writer.
But you're still, Paul, waiting for your legal status to be sorted in terms of where you can. Can I just ask you,
I want to be is Irish. It's no big deal.
And you're here now, are you? You're in Belfast now.
I'm in Dublin.
Oh, you're in Dublin now.
I arrived here today, and tomorrow I'm going to Mount Jerome Cemetery to lay some flowers on all those babies that were just thrown in a hole. And I'm only doing it for them, because in this day and age, why can't governments or the churches just put their hand up and say, yeah, we made mistakes, that's fine. I have to forgive people, but I can't go to church. How can I look at... I'd love to go to church, but every time I walk in there, I just think what the church has done to my life.
There is a very hard legacy. There's no doubt about that, Paul. But you're going to meet your brother, the brother you never knew you had, next week,
right.
Is it?
I'll be in London tomorrow, in London next week. And I'll put my arms around him, and no doubt we'll have a cry. But I've finally got someone that belongs to me. You know, and the first person who ever told me that they loved me was my wife. And I was never loved. And I became impossible to love because of drink, because I always thought to love yourself was a sin.
But your wife stuck with you for 60 years,
my
Paul.
My wife and my three kids went through hell with me. I've got my eldest son sitting here next to me, and God love him. He was the oldest. He's 50-odd now. And he remembers searching the streets for me to see where I was. But I was never out of work. I just loved that fantasy of getting out of my life. I'd close my eyes at night and I'd see myself getting raped. You know, it was just terrible.
Well, Paul,
Alcoholics Anonymous, and thanks to an awful lot of people, I've lived a wonderful life.
I was just going to say that. You're an extraordinary man to have survived what you have survived and the background that you came out of, and with nobody there to bring you through those early years. So I want to say, I'm sure every listener listening to you today will want to wish you the absolute best of luck and that with that meeting with your brother next week, and that finally you have, as you say, someone who belongs to you.
And Katie, I listened to your programme for the first time today, and that dementia thing is, I hope anybody out there that is suffering from it or caring for it, do go and get help. In Sydney, it is fantastic. I have a nurse comes every month, sits down with me, talks to my wife. Any care I need, whatever I need. They put bed rails on my bed because I was still having nightmares about the past and I was falling out of bed. That's fine. Now I've come to terms with everything, and I think next week, meeting my brother will be a closure on that part of it. But I promise myself, till the day I die, I will fight the Irish government and the Church of Ireland to say, all I'm asking you to do, I want to be Irish. Can you not just give me a passport? I never want to use it, but something that I can say to my kids and my grandkids, I'm Irish.
This is who I am.
I've got nothing. I'm known as a man with no citizenship whatsoever. And I think, I remember going to America, a friend of mine from Bethany couldn't get a visa because Paul Graham didn't exist. Why have you got on there, Paul Graham? We've checked our records. We will not give you a visa.
Paul, I'm going to have to go. I could talk to you all day, but I am going to have to go right now. But thank you so much for sharing your life story with us. And as I say, wish you the absolute best of luck next week.
Thank you very much, Katie. Thanks for your compassion and thank you for letting me do it.
Thanks, Paul.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. 51551.